You're joking. Not another one? Oh, for God's sake, I can't honestly, I can't stand this. There's too much politics going on at the moment.
French President Charles de Gaulle said politics is too serious a matter to be left to the politicians. Ancient Greek politician Pericles said, just because you do not take an interest in politics, doesn't mean that politics won't take an interest in you. And former UK Government Director of Communications Malcolm Tucker said, come the fuck in or fuck the fuck off. With all that in mind, this is Blethered at the Ballot, a political podcast that pulls no punches, brings a laugh or two and cuts straight through to the important matters without getting caught up in political jargon and meaningless soundbites. The general election is fast approaching, and before we collectively decide who to put in power, we deserve to know the thoughts of those who currently have it, those who want it and those who are near it. The first guest on Blethered at the Ballot is Dr. Sandesh Gulhani. He's been a Scottish Conservative and Unionist MSP for Glasgow since 2021. He's Shadow Cabinet Secretary for Health and Social Care, and he's a practising NHS GP. He also holds the distinction of being the first Hindu and first man of Indian descent to be elected to the Scottish Parliament. Now campaigning to be elected to Westminster as an MP, Sandesh has been chosen as a Conservative candidate for East Renfrewshire, a seat currently held by the SNP's Kirsten Oswald. This is our conversation about the friendliness of Glaswegians, how he ended up in Scottish politics, my questions and observations about the Conservatives' record after 14 years in government, Douglas Ross's leadership, and his hopes for the election. If you enjoy this podcast, share it somewhere so that others can enjoy it as well. Cheers. Dr. Sandesh.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you for being the first Blethered at the Ballot guest.
Pleasure.
I'll let you relax. Don't worry, it's all going to be friendly. But as I kind of had said to you, it's, you know, I just want to have conversations with people who I might be, on paper, you and I are diametrically opposed, but I think there's probably a lot of common ground there as well. MSP for Glasgow since May 2021, the first male of Indian descent to be elected to Holyrood. How does a doctor from London, educated at Imperial College in London, wind up in the cutthroat, volatile sort of landscape of Scottish politics? How does that happen?
Well, I've got a Glaswegian wife. That's the big way. So we had our first son down in London, and when she woke up in ITU a week later, she said, "I'm moving to Glasgow."
She back. Just thought, "I want to be near."
Yeah, there was
no
discussion. There was no. It was not a. Oh, we're thinking about doing this in advance. No, she woke up in ITU and just went, I'm going back to Glasgow. So that was it. We came up. I was an orthopaedic registrar when I came here and I loved it. You know, I thought when I first got here, I thought, look, I'm going to spend a year in Glasgow because that's where my wife's from. And then I'm going to go to Edinburgh because that's more like London, isn't it?
That'll please a lot of Glaswegians and wind up a lot of people for Edinburgh.
Do you know, that's what you think when you're in London.
Yeah.
That's, you know. But actually, I got here and I remember I couldn't find my way around, and I was sort of down Sucky Hall Street and I wasn't sure where I was going. And so I asked somebody, unusually for a man, but I asked someone, how'd you get to there? And this guy was going the opposite direction. And he said, oh, it's over there. You turn left, you go that way. Do you know what? I'll take you. Now, in London, my entire body is screaming, this is bad. Don't follow somebody. And this guy took me to where I wanted to go and said, it's around that corner. And that was my first experience of Glaswegians and people who are from Glasgow. And you know that saying of people make Glasgow? Well, it's so true, because that's the moment I realised actually, I love the city.
And that makes me happy to hear that. It's when I'm in London, I still retain all my sort of Glaswegian characteristics.
Oh, do you talk to people on the tube?
I'm the head case that talks to people on the tube. And I'm like, I now realise, having now worked there a lot and spend a lot of time there, but I've now over time realised, like, oh no, you look like a nutcase. But I, if you just catch somebody's eye or something funny happens, I'm always kind of wanting to get a wee laugh, and people are like, you know, head down. And
oh no, there's a look on the tube. Or on public transport in London. So you can't look somebody in the eye, but then you don't want to be too submissive and look down at the shoes. So there's this midway look that you do on the tube as you're just going along.
Yeah, as you're bobbing along.
That's it, this stare.
I'm here just like looking directly in the eyes. Talk to me, let's get a laugh. Scottish Conservatives, why the Scottish Conservatives? Have you always had a sort of affiliation with the party in general? And also, how then does it come about that you decide to run for office?
So the first thing to say is I wasn't really in politics. I'm a doctor, and I've always wanted to be a doctor, apart from once when I was 18, where I did think about trying to become a pilot in the RAF. That was
hardly any difference.
No, very, very little. But I mean, much like Top Gun, which a lot of people don't actually know anymore. I mean, it's terrifying. People haven't watched the original Top Gun anyway. But in there, I thought I could be a fighter pilot, which would be the coolest thing. But it's much more likely, if I do become a pilot, I would end up flying rubber dog shit out of Hong Kong. Right? And I decided, actually, what I'll do is I'll become a doctor. And if I still want to join the RAF, I can always do that as a doctor. So you did that, went through. And then I was an orthopedic surgeon. That's what I really wanted. I wanted to operate. And I loved being an orthopaedic surgeon. I said, I came here, I was working at the Queen Elizabeth, as it was then, as an orthopaedic registrar. And it was great, loved it. But with family, with time, looking at what my bosses were doing, I thought, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be the boss. And if you don't want to be the consultant, then what are you doing? So I moved over into GP. And I suddenly had loads of free time. You know, I wasn't staying late to operate. I wasn't doing audits and research and all the things. And so I then realised there was this world open to me. So I joined the BMA and I became chair of BMA GP trainee. So during the pandemic, we looked at ways to help trainees do their exams. We looked
BMA
at ways,
by the British Medical Association.
Yes, yeah. So they're the union for doctors. So I was looking at ways of helping people go through their exams and just trying to ensure that things were better. So I did that for 2 years. I was Queen's Park head of medicine, which is possibly the best job I've ever had.
Queen's Park, for anyone unaware, the oldest football club in Scotland.
They are indeed. Andy Robertson.
The OGs.
Andy Robertson is our... in fact, did you know the first international was Queen's Park versus...
It was Queen's Park versus England?
Yes.
So, right, okay. So they would have been the only team sort of with something resembling a sort of squad to play. Wow.
Yeah.
Was that at the, what's now the bowling club at Florida?
So. Yeah.
There's a mural that says this game took place here. How long were you at Queen's Park?
About 3 years.
Ah, right, okay.
Absolutely love that.
What time period are we talking? Because now Queen's Park, we're a hell of a lot of investment. You've got Lord Willie Hockey who's putting money in, and they've kind of gone more professional. They were famously amateur, competing in professional leagues. So that's been the last few years now. They've got their newly developed stadium. What?
So I finished and I stopped doing it just as they,
as the
money started coming in.
Your expenses would have been brilliant as well.
Yeah, sadly not. I was doing it basically for free. But I loved it. Yeah. It was so much fun. So I was doing all of that. And then the pandemic hit, like properly hit. Mm. Now, I'm a doctor on the front line. I was seeing people. Now, you have got to remember, back then, we didn't know what COVID was, what the virus was, how you contracted it. What did it mean to kids and babies? So, you know, I was at work. We were completely changing what we were doing. We were wearing bin bags and we had stuff donated from... the Girl Guides, I think, gave us some goggles.
Swimming goggles?
No, like big goggles to put on to sort of protect our eyes, and dust masks and stuff like this. You know,
it's nuts, wasn't it?
It wasn't, but I had a newborn baby. I didn't know what this virus meant to my baby, so I didn't hug my child for the first 6 weeks of her life.
Oh, God.
Because I didn't want to give her something
Yeah.
Potentially. So during that period, you know, whilst everyone was saying what an amazing job Nicola was doing, I was sitting there going, that's just not the case. Like, there's so many problems that I'm facing here in Scotland that nobody is talking about.
So what are some of the things that pissed you off sufficiently? Is that what then inspired you to get into politics then?
So I thought, well, instead of moaning about it, let's do something about it.
So what were you unhappy about?
So let me give you one example. So we got a bunch of delivery of masks that came in, and there was this sticker on top of the box. Now, the first thing you're going to do is, you're inquisitive, is wonder what's underneath the sticker. And underneath the sticker was a different sell-by date. So these masks had gone out and they were past their use date. But there was just a random sticker shoved on top saying it's fine to use. You know, no explanation, nothing. So potentially I've got out-of-date masks that I'm using. Right, how is that going to help me? How is that going to protect me when I'm seeing people? We saw that the information that we were being given, you know, Nicola would come on, and I remember telling a patient something, and it was like, this is what you must do, this is how you follow the rules. And literally 5 minutes later, that was totally different. And
I mean, would people not push back and say that it was a constantly ever-changing situation? I mean, you did say, because I'm no part of the government, I'm no affiliation to the Scottish National Party or Nicola Sturgeon, so I'm not to defend, but obviously in the interests of pushing back and debate. I mean, you mentioned it was an unpredictable situation in which we didn't know kind of how things were developing and unfolding. It was kind of people going. So where do you strike the balance between failure from government and lack of predictability in this situation at hand?
Of course, there's a variation and a change that does occur, but it was occurring basically weekly at one point. You know, the advice was wear masks, don't wear masks. No, absolutely you can't wear masks. No, we must wear masks. We were going through a period where we were told we must go here, we must do that. Well, no, we can't do that. We've got to pull back. And it was these wild differences that we're going. And we were getting, and what we were being told as well, you know, so, you know, the government advice that was actually coming through to us was telling us absolutely this is what we do. Not, look, we're going to be doing this. There is uncertainty, which means we might go here, we might go there, but that's what I think we're going to be doing.
How do you feel the Scottish government performed comparatively to, you know, from what was coming out of Westminster?
So I feel a little bit vindicated based on what we're seeing in the COVID inquiry, based on what we're beginning to hear, because I think that we're beginning to see it wasn't this picture of somebody who was on top of the detail, knowing what they were doing, having this going out and having the media personality and persona. You know, you saw Humza Yousaf saying that he was basically winging it. And actually, if you see his record through government, he is winging it. And what we're seeing here is, if you look at the way that the different governments handled things, it wasn't a publicity event for the UK government, you know, dependent upon what the scheme was
But comparatively, I appreciate the point, but comparatively,
but depending on what was going on. So Rishi would come out when he would talk about the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. If, you know, you'd have the Alok coming out when he would talk about housing and, you know, all these different things, you had different ministers coming on. In Scotland, it was just Nicola.
But do you think, so you mentioned Eat Out to Help Out, do you think that was a good decision?
At the time?
Well, do you think it was a good decision?
Well, you can only look at things at the time. So let's talk about lockdown, and we'll come on to Eat Out to Help Down. I, whilst I was here, said we need to lock down. Okay, and it was, and we did lock down, and you. I don't know if you wouldn't have heard me, but
frustrating as it was.
But I didn't argue the point with Nicola about that. I thought, yes, okay, it's reasonable for us to lock down. In hindsight, looking back, that wasn't a good move.
Eat Out to Help Out.
No, lockdown.
You think lockdown was a bad move?
In hindsight, yeah, it was.
So in hindsight, do you think Eat Out to Help Out was a positive?
But at the time, I thought Eat Out to Help Out was a good move. So, it was a way to ensure that the economy, especially the service industry, which was on its knees at the time, was able to get people back in to give people confidence. In hindsight, we know it spread the virus. But again, that's in hindsight. So you can only really be honest with people about what you thought at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought at the time.
We'll come back to Rishi Sunak, because obviously a lot to talk about with him. Obviously the leader of the Conservative Party, and has been for quite a wee while now. For how much longer, I'm not too sure. But let's talk about the leader of the Scottish Conservatives. Now, a large number of Scots still think that Ruth Davidson as the leader of the Conservatives in Scotland. Now, why do you think that is? And is that a negative or a positive?
Ruth Davidson's a positive. She is a generational politician who came along and she spoke across the divide. It's very rare to get somebody like that. You know, I wish I could do that. I wish I had her appeal. And I think most people, if they're being honest, wish they had her appeal as well.
Do you think, well, does that point to a sort of ineffectiveness in Douglas Ross's leadership?
No, not at all.
So but, why but do people
different.
Then...
But it's different. You know, you can't come in and be Ruth. You can't come in and do the things that she did and have that ease and appeal across. In fact, very few politicians at all have ever had her appeal.
When did Douglas Ross's leadership start?
Well, it started just before the election.
So 21. Just a bit before May 2021.
20.
I mean, 3 years, surely. If you're going to be a viable opposition, should people not know that you're the leader of your party?
A lot of people don't know that health is fully devolved to Humza and the Scottish government.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a kind of separate thing. I mean,
but it's not.
In terms of what's a reserve power and devolved power, I appreciate that people might not understand that, but that's kind of more of a sort of nuanced thing that you would, if you had, let's say, an involvement in the political sphere in general, even if only through interest, that I would expect somebody to know that. But to know who the leader of the party is, I mean, to me, I would think, well, that smacks of someone who's maybe is not all in, because he obviously has other commitments. He's an MP, has been since, was it 2015? And he's obviously a linesman. Can't remember what his other job is, and an MSP, so it's a lot. And it makes me wonder if people don't know that he is the leader of the party and they still think it's Ruth Davidson, then that makes me think, is that a viable opposition or a realistic opposition?
Well, I think we are a realistic and a viable opposition. And actually, if you look at Douglas's leadership, it's very clear that he's making difficult decisions and he is making correct decisions, and we are moving forwards. You know, if you look at, I knock on a lot of doors, especially recently, and by doing this, I'm speaking to people and they do not know that health is devolved. A lot of people are blaming Westminster for the problems we have in our NHS, you know, directly saying the queue is long because of Westminster, and you point out that that's not the case, they're surprised. And when it comes to politics, I think there has been fatigue. People are a little bit enough now when it comes to politics, because we've had so much going on. I mean, there's an election coming up, so people are going to have to gear up for that. But there is a bit of fatigue. Now, I think Douglas is the right person to be leading us. You know, I think that he is doing a good job. And I think that when you actually see what he says and how he's holding Humza to account, just yesterday we were talking about cancer stats. And Douglas pointed out our rates going up quite significantly in deaths. Drug deaths.
Do you think?
And Humza's response was nonplussed.
Do you think you can do a good job? Like, not a good job. Do you think you can do the job that the country deserves when you're a member of both houses? I mean, you're a member at Holyrood in the Scottish Parliament and also in Westminster. That to me seems like your time is fully split.
No, I mean, people accuse me of why are you a doctor? You know, why are you doing a day a week in the NHS? And what I would say is that Douglas spends some time in Westminster, but actually the majority of time and the focus that he spends is up in Holyrood, is up in Scotland, is in his constituency, which is where he represents both as an MP but also as an MSP. So he is very focused upon, you know, the things that any politician should do, which is look after where they're from, and also in leading and in the way that he is doing things within Holyrood and within the campus.
Personally speaking, I would be hoping that the leader of the party, or the Scottish Conservatives, or any Scottish party would be fully committed. I don't think that's an unreasonable sort of expectation. I just kind of wanted to come back to something you said about the devolution of obviously healthcare and NHS waiting lists. And I think the Scottish Government should be scrutinised, criticised and held to account for NHS performance, because it's under their watch. But to talk about, I mean, we'll look at sort of Westminster's record in general, because I do think it's relevant. So NHS waiting lists, NHS funding has risen in every year
in real terms since 2010 as a ring-fence commitment under the Tories. However, it has increased by far less than the long-term historical average. And obviously waiting lists are kind of through the roof. I think, God, I should have the graph to hand. I don't. I can get it up maybe in the screen if we're going to have this as a clip. How do you think the UK government has performed? Because obviously that's going to be relevant to you if you're running to be MP for East Renfrewshire. And sort of again, comparatively, because I think it is sort of good to look at their performance side by side.
Well, let me give you one example of a hospital in London, UCL. Looks after close to a few million people. You know, Glasgow doesn't have one hospital that looks after that many people.
Well, I mean, it's all relative to scale, isn't it? Because
exactly.
There's more people in London than there are in the entirety of Scotland.
Exactly. So it's doing a comparison between England and Scotland. It really doesn't work very well because of the significant differences that exist in England. But let's look at...
I don't know if I would agree with that, though, because, again, it's relative to scale, isn't it, in terms of population, in terms of budget, in terms of spending?
But, you see, when you've got a massive super hospital, which looks after more people than are in Glasgow, than are in Edinburgh, you are looking at something totally different.
Yeah, but we're talking about across the entirety of England, though, not just one specific hospital.
But that is
and
an
if,
example.
I think if NHS waiting lists are soaring, as much as, again, don't compare apples and oranges and sort of don't look to your neighbour and think, well, what are you doing? So that therefore excuses my underperformance. But I just see a certain irony in being hypercritical of the Scottish health system without an acknowledgement that NHS waiting lists are soaring down in England as well under, you know, a Conservative government.
Two-year waits have basically gone. We are seeing cancer treatments improving. If you look at the spend on the NHS, so just as you said, since the SNP came into power, if they actually spent the consequentials in healthcare, we would have £17 billion more to spend today than we do, instead of the way that they're spending their money. So we do need to look at real choices made by the SNP and the way that they're making their choices to how our healthcare is performing. Nicola Sturgeon cut nursing numbers when she was health secretary, and those decisions are coming home to roost now. We have our GP numbers are going down. We have 26 fewer GPs than we did when the promise was made to create 800 more. Now, a headcount's not the answer. It's full-time working. The difference between our rural communities and island communities and our urban communities is stark. There's a new contract we have created, which is penalising people in the highlands, in rural areas and island areas. These are all decisions that have been made that had they not been made, we would have a significant improvement in the way our healthcare. And my job as a member of the Scottish Parliament is to hold the SNP to account for my constituents and for the people of Scotland. And just as you said, I don't want to compare to France or to Germany or to England.
I'm talking about comparing Scotland and England.
Or England and Wales, because what matters is the healthcare provision that we could provide if we did a better job.
So you mentioned funding for nurses there. What do you think about the refusal to give nurses the pay rise that they were due for quite a while? That conversation dragged out a lot. I was covering it a lot in sort of breakfast TV. That was a Westminster decision, sorry. Yeah.
So, you know, I don't follow the Westminster conversation very carefully.
Hold on. Wait a minute, you're running to be an MP.
Yes, for
sure. So why are you not paying attention to what's happening in Westminster? Is that not sort of party connected?
No. So that is an English decision that is being made about the English NHS, and my focus is upon the Scottish NHS. But
so did you
fully
not
answer,
follow the story at
no,
all?
No, but to fully answer your question, whilst I didn't follow it in great detail and whilst I didn't, you know, it's not my job to then go and speak to the ministers to find out what's going on, as it would be if that decision was being made in Scotland. That is absolutely my responsibility to find out about it as much as I can in the background. So I didn't go and speak to a minister. I didn't go and speak to SPADs down at number 10 to find out what was going on. But the way that I saw it was what was being said was there was not the money available to give everything that they wanted to give, which includes the doctors. If you look at the junior doctor strikes that happened.
They're getting their piss taken out of them, aren't they?
Well, it's saying that there isn't the money to give a 30% increase.
As a healthcare professional, somebody who's put in so much time, and you know what you bring to the table, do you not think, I mean, speaking candidly, you maybe can't use this terminology, I will. I think it's really taking the piss out of them, the way that they've been treated, the way that they've been absolutely castigated for just asking for, I think, better working conditions, reasonable working conditions. I mean, does that not frustrate you? You're allowed to say that frustrates you.
So they're asking for a 30% pay increase. And I would love to sit here and go, we should be giving doctors a 30% pay increase. I would love to say that. But even, you know, if that came up in Scotland and the government refused to give a 30% pay increase, it's difficult. I wouldn't criticise Hoomsa for not giving a 30% pay increase, because that's really difficult. But, you know, do I think we should be paying our NHS staff more? Of course I do. Do I think we should be paying a far bigger amount? Of course I do. It's about finding that money. It's about making sure that we can afford to do it. But, you know, let's look at what we've done here. Agenda for Change has led to a significant increase in the amount of money that is being paid to staff who work in the Agenda for Change. I'm not going to begrudge anyone getting more money. GP, primary care, hasn't seen as big an increase. So what you're seeing is reception staff working in GPs who are getting up dog's abuse for doing their job, looking across at hospitals and saying, well, why don't I just go work in there? Because I get paid more money and I get less abuse. So we're losing staff in primary care because that money hasn't flowed. We're beginning to create a two-tier system. If you know, I created a vision for the NHS, for the Scottish NHS. It's modern, efficient, local. I did that about 6 weeks ago. We announced it. And 2 weeks later, Audit Scotland said the Scottish Government have absolutely no vision for the NHS. But within my paper, I talk about increasing the funding envelope to 12% for primary care. Now, why would that matter? Because one, we'd be able to pay our staff better. Two, if you or your listeners want to access the NHS, they go to primary care. They go and see a GP, somebody in the GP practice, a pharmacist, a physio. You know, in primary care, we deal with about 90% of all patient contacts that happens in the health service. So if we bolster that, we make that better, we're going to get a better health service overall. So, you know, that is the type of thing I've been concentrating on, creating real policies that work here in Scotland.
Let's talk about another increase in pay. So yesterday it was announced that MP salaries are to exceed £90,000. Now that's an increase of 5.5%. Starting from April. That's as per the Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority. It's in line with the rise that's been recently awarded to senior members of the civil service. How do you feel about that? What's your opinion on that? Because obviously we're in a period of record inflation, which is, doesn't show any signs really of starting to go down. People are really,
we've halved it.
People are really struggling. Do you think that that's fair? We're talking £91,346 a month. I think it is probably worth entering that you can claim expenses. Food and drink is heavily subsidised. I've had something to eat in Westminster and the House of Commons before. I couldn't believe the prices. You can enter reality TV shows, as Matt Hancock and Nadine Dorries and others have done. Do you think that's fair? Because it's 92 grand. You're taking a lot of that home with you.
So, I mean, the first thing to say is I've been to Westminster once when I went down to visit Douglas, and then I haven't really experienced the food and drink of Westminster, so I can't comment on that. I'll take your word for it.
I'm not saying that, but everybody knows that it's heavily subsidised. Like, your food is like less than the price of a coffee. It's nuts. That's kind of common knowledge.
But I genuinely haven't experienced that. So,
but you know.
That's not the point that you're making, but, you know,
You went out your way to make the point, so that's why I'm going to push back on it. Of course, you know. I think anybody listening would think, like, come on.
I don't know. So I'm not going to comment upon the food and drink prices, but what I will say is when you're making difficult decisions about doctors, about nurses, and you're looking at the pay increase you're giving them, I find it really difficult to to then say, well, actually, we're going to give ourselves a 5.5% pay
increase. I would
increase.
Actually like to point out that it's not, this isn't the decision of the MPs. They don't decide their
no,
wages.
You're right, it's
yeah,
independent.
I wanted to say that. It's independent. That was in the wake of the expenses scandal. So while I would ask the question, I'm also not, you know, sticking the boot in and saying, I can't believe you have given yourselves that much money. It's not the MP's decision. I want to make that clear to you listening.
But it's still a really difficult
yeah.
thing to hear. And people listening to you are going to say, well, my wage hasn't gone up 5.5%. So why is that fair?
Wage growth has flatlined since 2008. Mm-hmm. So wages from 1970 to 2007 had, per decade, an average of 33% growth. That has not gone up since 2008. It's been the same. In fact, it's at the same level as it was during the 2008 financial crisis. So it's basically saying that everybody should be 10... Theoretically speaking, should be £10,700 better off, and they're not. In fact, so you're £10,700 worse off. That's 14 years of Conservative leadership. I think there is a direct correlation there.
Well, we have seen an increase in the economy, and we've seen an increase in public spending. In fact, we had brought down the deficit, but post-COVID, that has skyrocketed, and we're just not going back to where we were. And you're right about wages. You know, if you look at doctors' wages, which is what I knew, that looked the same as it did before. But let me just bring you to one point. You know, here in Scotland, we're seeing, you've got something called discretionary points, where if you're a really good consultant, you get awarded discretionary points, saying actually you're doing everything that we and more, and that's why you're getting this point, and that equals a little bit more money, but actually it's quite prestigious. They've all been stopped, but the managers here in Scotland are giving themselves outstanding, despite the fact that they are sitting within a health board which is in special measures. That's something that I also can't stand. You know, I want to see regulation of NHS managers brought in for that. Going back to your point about the 5.5%, yes, look, it is independent. I'm not an MP. I have no say in it, but it's a really difficult look for MPs, and it's not something that I would massively support if that was a choice we had.
You know, I really respect you saying that, because it's it's very easy to, well, I suppose on one hand it's very easy for you to say, well, I'm not part of that and it's terrible, but it would also be easy for you to kind of say no, you know, and kind of fob that question off. Fair enough.
Just on money, you know, being an MSP compared to being a full-time GP, which is what I would be, you know, I've taken a significant pay cut. Now, I don't, you know, no one's going to feel sorry for me. It's a choice that I've made. You know, for me, it's about public service. It's about giving back to people. It's about trying to make things better. So we do need the public. You can't make things better if the public don't trust you and the public don't think that you are one of them. And so that's something that when you look at things like this pay increase, that gives you a separation between a them and us, and that's not good.
You're completely right there. You mentioned the deficit, excuse me, and cutting the deficit. So UK government debt has reached its highest level since the 1960s. I mean, how do you sort of square that circle?
The pandemic, borrowed and paid huge amounts of money. And then we were hit directly after that with the Ukraine war. Mm. So our debt levels are astronomical right now. And do you know what? They are way too high. We need to desperately do something about it. Rishi has brought down inflation.
By how much? I mean,
he's halved it.
It's still fucking up a bit.
Yeah,
12%. So it's still through the roof.
No, it's a big number. He's halved inflation, and
but
we
that's
are
like,
seeing
that's
green shoots
like me,
coming back.
If I say, you know, there's a fire, and I've put half of it out, and it's like, well, I started the fire in the first place. That's how I see it.
Well, no, it's a global issue. It's not a conservative made issue. This is a global issue. You know, there's no way that you can say the war in Ukraine has anything to do with the Conservative Party.
No way
you can see the pandemic has anything to do with the Conservative Party.
Honestly, I just think that's a get out. I mean, right, so underinvestment, for example, there's been a huge lack of investment. So the Institute for Public Policy Research think tank has estimated that UK has underinvested to the tune of £500 billion, or 30 Elizabeth lines, if you want to kind of look at it as that. The Elizabeth line is a London Underground line that was installed. London getting good use of that, the rest of the UK not. But that's become visible in, you know, crumbling schools, hospitals, infrastructure. I mean, lack of investment, it begets a lack of productivity, doesn't it? So, I mean, I wouldn't put that down to the Ukraine war or the pandemic, nor would I put food bank usage spiralling. 3 million food bank parcels were distributed in the year from March 2022 to March 23. Poverty's, over the last 14 years, there's been an explosion in food banks. So, I mean, according to the Trussell Trust, right, we have seen, I had the statistics. So basically from the Trussell Trust, 2010, 100,000 food parcels. 2023, 3 million a year. I mean, is that Ukraine war and pandemic as well? Or?
Some of it is, but...
A small part.
But one of the reasons I got into politics, one of the reasons I want to go to Westminster, is I want to make that better.
Will you still stay on as an MSP?
No.
No, you chuck it?
So well, like, I won't oh, chuck it, I'll resign because...
chuck it, resign, tomato, tomato.
Well, because actually if I was representing an area within Glasgow, there could be an argument, you know, I'm representing the same people, but East Renfrewshire sits outside of Glasgow.
Yeah.
So that there is a choice to be made. And quite rightly, the people of Glasgow will say, are you concentrating on me? And people of East Renfrewshire would ask me the same question.
So you know, I think so Douglas Ross should do the same if he's the leader of the party.
But he's representing Murray, and both in Holyrood and in Westminster, so it's the same constituents.
Oh, so it falls. I mean, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I didn't realise that. Actually, I thought it would be a slight difference.
No. It's the same constituents. He's got a slightly wider remit in Holyrood, but it includes Murray.
It's a tough one, though, isn't it? Because if you're dealing with reserved issues and devolved issues and trying to balance both, I think that's probably why a lot of people maybe don't realise that he's the leader after 3 years. Right, so East Renfrewshire, let's talk it. Now, listen up, anybody from Barhead, Busby, Clarkston, Eaglesham, Giffnock, Newton Mearns, Neilston, Netherley, Thornley Bank and Uplaw Moor, sorry if I missed any. Current sitting MP is the SNP's Kirsten Oswald. She's got a majority of 5,426. Decent voter turnout, 76.6%. So people are engaged, would love that to be a lot higher. I'm sure you would as well. How do you overturn that? Because Jim Murphy of Labour had a 10,000 majority at the 2015 election, and then 2019 he's booted out. That's a huge swing.
You've not said it was Paul Masterton, the Conservative, who got in.
There we go. I stand corrected on that. So sorry, forgive me. So Kirsten takes over from Paul Masterton. How confident do you feel at, you know, turning that back around then?
So just before I answer that question, on that voter turnout point that you made there, I speak to a lot of school children and they always say, what's the one thing that you would say to us? What's the one piece of advice? And what I say to every single child I meet is you must vote. It is the single most important thing that you can do, because if you get 100% turnout across the country, then the way that politics would go would be very different. The way that we would, that the parties would be.
I don't think that would possibly go in your favour.
Do you know what? It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because I think voting is something we fought wars for. We have had movements over. Mm-hmm. I think it's the most important thing that we can do as members of the United Kingdom. I genuinely feel it's that important.
I know that when I asked this, we're kind of straying into something democratic becoming undemocratic, but would you make it compulsory to vote? It's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Australia do. But I would also put another box saying, I don't like any of them. So allowing people to genuinely express their view. So you've got all the different parties, and some of them go over like 3 pages now, but you've got all the different parties, and then you've got, I don't like any of them. And you can tick that box so that would then be recorded. So you don't feel as though you've got to make a choice if you don't like anything.
I suppose that's kind of the spoiled ballot thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but at least, you know, that way we are getting more people engaged. And I know that wasn't your question, but I really do feel passionate
about voting.
I really want them to vote. And you would see change overnight in the way that every party does politics, because you have to talk to everyone, not voters, you know, the people who do vote. So going back to East Renfrewshire, I am knocking on a lot of doors and I speak to people. And look, their number one issue is the roads and potholes. And that is the number one thing that virtually every person says to me. Some people say to me, oh, I'm not sure I've got an issue. And I say, well, what about the roads? And they go, oh, God, yeah, but we can't say that because it's just a disaster, isn't it?
Where does that resolution come from?
It's council. The roads are held by council. But that doesn't. People don't care if it's a Westminster issue or a Scottish Government issue or a council issue. What they care about is the issue. So knocking on all the doors. So that's the one thing that comes out resoundingly. It's like 100% of people. But behind that, I'm seeing a lot of people having apathy and anger towards the SNP. I'm seeing a lot of people not happy with the way that the government in Scotland is running. And I feel as though I have got a lot of support out there. A lot of people are willing to vote for me to get me into Westminster, to get me in as their MP. So I do feel confident.
How do you influence change against the Scottish Government, though, if you're in Westminster?
You influence change by making sure that, firstly, you have a party which talks to the people of Scotland, but also talks, you know, widely across the UK, but does talk to the people of Scotland. Secondly, there's a lot of things which happen in Westminster which does affect us here in Scotland. So we do all the devolved issues. We need to make sure that there is a strong Scottish focus upon issues that come up here. And that's something that I would bring to the people of East Renfrewshire. But also...
But how have we gone from... If roads are a council issue, who runs East Renfrewshire Council?
Labour.
Right, okay. So if roads are a council issue and people want you to go to Westminster to oppose a Labour council, I'm struggling to see how these all tie up.
Sorry, my apologies. So that's their issue. That's the number one thing that they care about. And what I can then do is speak to my councillors. I can speak to the people who do sit on the council. We can look at trying to solve their issues locally by speaking to appropriate councillor.
Why would they be pissed off at the SNP for roads under a Labour council?
So that might be their number one issue.
But that's what you said.
That's the number one issue.
You said that they're pissed off about the roads, so they want to elect you to Westminster to counteract the Scottish Government, but that's a Labour issue.
Sorry, perhaps I wasn't clear. So what I was saying is the number one issue I see the doors as 100% of people, this is what they say, so that's the number one issue. Then after that is what I'm hearing is about how there is a lot of anger and antipathy towards the SNP. So they're not wanting to vote me in because of the road issue, but that was our number one issue. The next issue that I hear from people is about that anger with the SNP, about how they're very upset with the way that they're going about things.
About, you know, like, what are the main things? Because they're saying, obviously, the roads are the main issue. What are the other issues that they bring up that they're upset about?
Ferries. People don't like the way that the ferries are wasting money. They don't like the idea of roads up in the Highland and Island areas. You know, you're looking at the A9 not being dualled.
Do you think people in East Renfrewshire are pissed off about the A9?
It speaks to a lack of investment.
I honestly believe that if I spoke to anybody anywhere in Glasgow and I'd be like, what do you think about the A9? I don't think they would have an opinion.
Glasgow's different to East Renfrewshire.
East Renfrewshire, then. I mean, it's right beside it, isn't it? It's people, one and the same, really. It's Greater Glasgow.
It is part of the conversations that I have. They're really upset about schools. They're really upset with the way that our schools and the education system is going, and they feel as though...
What are the main sort of points? Like, what is it they don't... What direction don't they like?
So the conversation I had recently is they've seen the cuts that have been made in Glasgow and they're terrified those cuts are going to come over to East Renfrewshire. They're seeing class sizes increase. They're seeing support staff start to disappear that they used to have for teachers. So within a class, you'd have a support teacher. They're seeing that eroded. They're really upset about the standards within schools dropping, though East Renfrewshire has.
So who's in charge of in terms of schools and stuff in East Renfrewshire? Does that also come under a Labour council?
So you've got the SNP, which are in charge of education.
Yeah.
And then the council delivers. Mm-hmm. But the council are not delivering, and they're telling us it's because of the way that the SNP are doing things, the way that they're being funded by the SNP. We're being told, you know, we saw the cabinet secretary for education go on TV to talk about violence in schools, not reading a report that was across her desk. So this is the type of thing that they're very upset about.
Fair enough. And if these are the issues that are bothering you, should you not be staying in Holyrood to combat that?
No, because I think that it's very important. We have a lot of good people in Holyrood. Liam Kerr is our education spokesperson, for example, and he's very good at things. And he's very good at holding them to account about this. And he's already brought this issue up a number of times within Parliament in questions directly to the Cabinet Secretary. But I feel that actually as a representative for the people of East Renfrewshire, I would be able to help them with that. I would then be able to go and speak to the people within Holyrood that can help make that change. I can also look at other things that matter to the people of East Renfrewshire. And look, one of the things that's happening is Kirsten Oswald is going around telling everyone that East Renfrewshire wants independence because that's her mandate. But it was the highest Remain within the UK vote within within Scotland. So
Kirsten's been invited on, not as of yet heard back from her staff, but that's something that she would have to directly respond to, because obviously I can't speak on her behalf, but I would
line one page one is what the SNP say about independence, and it's their only focus is what Humza has said, and so I'd imagine that she's taken the whip with that, and that's what the people of East Renfrewshire are getting.
Let's talk about racism. Have you experienced racism within your sort of political role, you know, so to speak?
Of course I have.
I'm sorry to hear that. What, I mean, has it been a common theme, or is it, I would hope that it would be sparse or more rare than it was frequent? Like, what's been your experience?
No, I mean, look, I don't want to come on here and say, oh, look, feel sorry for me.
No,
you're
well entitled to give your experience.
But yeah, I mean, I get DMs that come into my social media accounts, people that shout things at me in the street.
That's shocking.
We all get some form of abuse, and mine just happens, some of it crosses that line into racism. You know, there's some people within Parliament are getting death threats. So we are seeing a bit of a change occurring within the way that people are sort of interacting with their politicians into a quite a things. There's a nasty undertone which is coming through.
Let's, I think there's been obviously a very recent sort of incident or story unfolding with Frank Hester. He's a businessman and largest ever donor to the Conservative Party. Now, he's given a reported £10 million in donations. Tortoise Media are speculating that it's actually closer to £15 million. He recently, for anyone who's unaware, was reported by The Guardian to have said about Labour MP Diane Abbott, "It's like trying not to be racist, but you see Diane Abbott on the TV and you just want to hate all black women because she's there. And I don't hate all black women at all, but I think she should be shot." Only recently, it's only been under severe sustained pressure that the Conservative Party in Westminster have categorised that as racist and obviously misogynistic. I mean, what are your thoughts on that as it's unfolded? I've got a few questions for you, and yeah, I'm just keen to see what your perspective is on it. I mean, worth actually saying, if I can preface it by saying, Douglas Ross was asked about it. He said they were racist, unacceptable and wrong. There's no dubiety around that. It was unacceptable, and the party at a UK level needs to look at that donation. Wants to, but how do you feel about that, taking that money? That's about, I think, about 42% of the entire Conservative spending budget for a 12-month period donated.
That money came before he made the comments. It's not like...
The money came after he made the comment in 2019, and the money came up to a couple of months ago. So he made the money. He made the donation about 5 years after he said it.
Right. So when it came out, that was... I didn't know he'd said that until... just there.
Oh yeah, no one did. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, so that's the point I was making. You know, I think it's one thing.
Should they give the money back?
That's up to the UK party to
make a decision. But do you think they should give it back? Because you're looking to be part of that government.
I I genuinely think they need to very carefully look at it and decide whether...
Would you just give it back? I would give it back. If it was me, I'd be like, no, we can't. There comes out, you have to draw a line in the sand and say, do you know what? We can't take this. Yeah.
And look, the first thing to say is it was a racist comment.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I agree with everything that Douglas has said there. You know, there's not a single word that he said that I disagree with. Should they give the money back?
Yeah, I think they should.
I would like to see it happen, but it's not my decision. It's a decision that rests with the UK party, and it's a decision that needs a genuine review. And the one thing that I would say is, you know, it was quite right that he has apologised.
Of course he didn't apologise. So he apologised for being rude, but he didn't acknowledge any racism. Now, I think
we need to go back and ask.
No. So he's been asked, believe me. Right, so we'll go over a couple of things, right? So Michael Gove was asked about it, and all he said was, he was asked, would you condemn it, call it racist, should the money come back? All he said was, Frank Hester is a philanthropist and someone who's done a lot of great things for British business, and then sat down. Rishi Sunak basically was saying it was wrong. This is the constant sort of party line, was it's wrong. It's only now that it's been, oh, it's racist, but we're still going to keep the money. I find that really jarring. I find his comments, I heard someone say they found it disturbing. I thought that was the sort of the best word for it. Because obviously relevant, pointing out in October 2021, Sir David Amos was stabbed to death in Leon C, my old constituency. Joe Cox, Labour MP, shot and stabbed in Yorkshire by a British neo-Nazi in 2016. Hearing comments like that, she should be shot. Fucking hell. Like, Jesus Christ. That's serious stuff. And to not hear any sort of condemnation or, yeah, you know, we're going to separate ourselves from that and distance ourselves from that. I mean, why is there not a pushback in that?
I can only talk for myself. I'm not actually down there in Westminster within the UK party. I'm in the Scottish party, and our position about what he said, what that means, is very clear. And it is a decision that needs to be made at the UK level.
I think
that we need to have real serious considerations of giving that money back.
So, yeah, I mean, I respect your stance on it. I think it's completely right. But do you not think that then points to like a serious disparity or division between the Scottish Conservatives and the Conservatives down in Westminster? I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg, when he was asked about Douglas Ross, he called him a lightweight who said he shouldn't be listened to when he'd called for Boris Johnson's resignation in 2022. And that, to me, I feel, you know, as a voter, I wonder, is there a connection? Is it a satellite party? Are the Scottish Conservatives just an afterthought? I mean, how do you...
I mean, if you say something that you don't agree with, then Douglas was saying something which was the opposite of what Jacob thought.
But to call the leader a lightweight...
Well, it's wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I
mean, there's no other other way of saying it. He shouldn't have done that. Have you ever heard Penny Mordaunt speaking in Westminster when she answers Scottish questions and she answers questions for the SNP? There is somebody, you know, who knows exactly what's going on. You know, we obviously, everyone talks. She is very good at knowing what's going on in Scotland and coming and saying what we all think.
But what's the connection with Penny?
Oh no, my point is, she is an example of somebody within the party that is speaking up for Scotland, speaking up for the people of Scotland. You know, the great strength in the Conservative Party is that people can say things. People are allowed to have a different opinion. It's a very broad church. It's not authoritarian like we see at SNP level, you know, where you cannot speak out, you cannot say anything. Look at Fergus, lost the whip. You know, this is something it happens within the Conservative Party. Is it right? No, of course not. I don't think Douglas is a lightweight. I don't think that comments...
Former leader of the leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg, certainly thought so.
Yes, but I don't agree with any of his comments. But he made them, and I think that they were wrong.
Final two quick questions. Can you think of any example off the top of your head where any Conservative MP has come out, has gone against the grain and spoken out? You know, you're saying... Well,
Douglas.
No, Conservative MP aside from Douglas Ross, because he's obviously got to... He was pushed in that, wasn't he? Because it was about Boris Johnson attending a drinks reception or something during COVID, and it was eventually pushed, and he said, yeah, I think he should resign, to kind of be slapped back down. Okay, I'll leave that one. Final question. First of all, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciated it, back and forward. There is a real prospect of a serious Tory wipeout in 1997, a general election result scale. Do you see a way back for the Conservative Party at the election? I mean, there's rumours that they're going to call a snap election for May.
Well, a friend of mine's put £20 on a 5-1.
Oh, really? So, wait, we'll stick £50 on that.
Do you know, I'm not sure that there'll be a May election. In fact, didn't Rishi say that there won't be a May election?
Sure. I think he said they weren't decided.
ITV Borders or something. I think he said it wouldn't be the 2nd of May. Anyway, don't quote me on that. But yeah. I think that's what he said. I don't think there'll be a May election. Anyway, that doesn't mean that you can put a bet on or not. It's not insider information. That's just my thinking.
Bracketeer.
But I do think that we are, you can see the polls. You know, everyone needs to open their eyes to the polls.
Do you know, so they put a poll conducted yesterday, the results were released yesterday, which stated that support for the Conservatives were at its lowest point since Liz Truss's resignation.
So the first thing to say, and this is really important for your listeners, those polls conducted in England and the UK, the last one, for example, had about 1,000 people, of which 20 were Scottish. They do not represent what we are going through here in Scotland. So the people of East Renfrewshire, you know, the idea that my core vote is going to disappear and go elsewhere is just complete fantasy.
Well, I don't know about that, because you get so many people defecting to Reform. I mean, Lee Anderson is now on his third party. Now, I wonder if he ate his crayons after he wrote his resignation letter. You're allowed to laugh, go on.
There's a lot of, I mean, Rishi
Sunak's been warned. There's a lot of people possibly thinking about going over. That's going to really split the Conservative vote. Possibly not in Scotland, but down in England, it certainly will.
In England, that will certainly be a massive problem. Lee Anderson defecting to the Reform Party.
Well, there's no great loss to anybody.
That was his choice. You know, especially the comments that he made about Orkney. I couldn't agree with that at all. Anyway, moving on from him, the UK picture is not the picture in Scotland, because it's not a two-party race in Scotland. There's a third party here. It's the SNP. And
they're the first party, really, aren't they? Well, they hold the majority of the seats.
In the UK, they're the third party. And,
yeah, okay,
and
fair enough.
They are a major player in Scotland. They hold a huge number of the MP seats in Scotland. The vast majority, in fact.
Yeah.
So the politics in Scotland and the politics in the United Kingdom are different. The way our voters are going to vote is different. I think our voters are very tactically astute when it comes to the way they're voting. My vote in East Renfrewshire is not going to collapse. Just simply speaking to people on the doors, it's not going to collapse.
But so, you're speaking to them in Newton Mearns, or are you speaking to them in Barrhead?
I'm going all the way around the constituency. What's the point of just speaking to your voters, or what you think is your voters? And in fact, that's another thing. Who you think traditionally votes Conservative is not necessarily the case. You know, we have aspiring people who want lower taxes, and they want to continue to grow their sole business, their sole job, their small business, and they are voting Conservative in areas that you'd be very surprised that people vote Conservative. So we need to go and talk to everyone. And my job is to speak to as many people as possible between now and whenever polling might be, to listen to them.
Well, time will tell. So, Dr. Sandish, wishing you all the best in the upcoming election and for the next few years ahead. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
My life is just an old routine. Every day the same damn thing. I couldn't even tell I was alive. I tell you, the high cost of living ain't nothing like the cost of living high.